everybody, and welcome back to yet another very exciting episode of the Friends Talking Fantasy Podcast. My name is Charles, and with me today, as always, is my lifelong friend and co-host, Dylan.
I'm ready to talk some fantasy again with my friend Charles. It's been a little bit of a break.
Yes.
I'm sorry to all you who've been anxiously awaiting the next Friends Talking Fantasy Podcast, but we are back. Can we say where you were, Charles?
Yeah, we could say where we were. The delay is my fault. The delay is my fault. I was busy getting married, so
Ayo.
Married now. Ayo, off the market, sorry. And was on the honeymoon, went to Italy, you know, and got to see like the Colosseum, got to see Venice, Rome, you know, all these cool spots that many fantasy stories have been inspired by. So it was cool to see, cool to do, but it's good to be back and in the motion of the show again. So thank you all for your patience, and we're getting back to it in a interesting way. You know, it's the reading schedule's been kind of delayed from all of our, you know, time off, I guess you could say, and travels and things, but that didn't mean that I stopped reading or that Dylan stopped reading. And you know, I live in the United States, and getting all the way to Italy, you know, it's a long travel time, and so I had the opportunity to cross some books off the TBR, and that's why we're here today. I'm here today to talk about one of the books I read during my travels. This is The Once and Future King by T.H. White. So,
an absolute classic of the genre, Charles, and one of those books that I know for me has been sitting on the TBR forever because my perception, which may or may not be accurate, is, okay, this is something that I know is important to read from a context perspective, from a historical perspective, all that. But I'm like, how much am I actually going to enjoy the process of reading this book? And I've had that kind of impression before about books and then been pleasantly surprised. Probably most recently would be Dune, where I thought, okay, this is extremely influential, not just on sci-fi, but on fantasy. And I'm like, am I really going to like the process of reading it? I did. I really did. And Charles, that has me curious. I think you probably had a similar perception coming into reading the book. Was it that way when you actually read it, or did you really enjoy the process of reading it? Tell me all about it.
That's a great question. You know, for me too, Dylan, and I think I've brought it up on the show a couple times, and I know we've talked about it before. This book has been on my TBR for like a decade, and I had the same reservations that you just voiced of like, oh man, it's got all these great endorsements. And then look, I'm like, ooh, it's from like the 50s, like written as early as the 30s. Like it's super, it's like five books into one. So it's kind of chunky now at this point. And it's just like so many other fantasy books to read. I don't know if I'm ready. You know, I just don't know if I'm ready. And I always just kept kicking it down the line. And I said, you know what? There's no like immediate releases, nothing I have to read for the show. I've got and 9 to 11 hours of traveling on this plane. So this is a good time to finally crank this one out. And I'll say it's kind of a mixed bag. Like, there was a lot about this book that really impressed me and was not what I was expecting, and in a lot of ways was very modern. But I'll also say, like, I guess because I was just reading it, like marathoning it pretty much, it was a bit of a lot for me at the same time. So it wasn't like this edge of my seat, like reading experience where I'm like, this book is amazing, I'm so enraptured. But I was reading it and I'm like, this book is very interesting. You know, it's not what I was expecting, and it's impressive in a lot of ways. So I guess I'll just get into, like, for those of you that don't know, The Once and Future King by T.H. White. I'll just read a description. It's basically a retelling of the legends of King Arthur, which you think about it these days, I feel like a lot of new books these days, I hear the word spiritual retelling like over and over. So it's kind of funny to have a retelling from the 50s or tonal retort. I've only heard that once and never again. But I've heard retellings are very much in vogue right now. And here's a retelling from a long time ago, generations ago. So it's kind of interesting to kind of see that trend in an earlier time. But basically, here's the description. I'll just get into that before I go any further. Once upon a time, a young boy called Wart was tutored by a magician named Merlin in preparation for a future he couldn't possibly imagine, a future in which he would ally himself with the greatest knights, love a legendary queen, and unite a country dedicated to chivalrous values, a future that would see him crowned and known for all time as Arthur, King of the Britons. So pretty standard synopsis there. It's the legend of King Arthur. We may know things like the Sword in the Stone and the Knights of the Round Table, and we all know Merlin and all these classic tales. But what particularly put this book on my radar 10 years ago, you know, I was going through the bookstore and I was looking for new books to read, and I always kept coming across this book and I always kept reading all of these endorsements. So I thought it might be interesting to read some of these endorsements and some of these authors giving these endorsements, just so you readers at home can understand why I was like, how could you not read this when you read stuff like this? So I've got about 3 or 4 of them that I'll just read. It won't take long at all. They're short. So I'll get into them super quickly. Here's one, and I'll tell you the author afterwards. White, the author, took hold of the ultimate English epic and recast it in modern literary language, sacrificing none of its grandeur or its strangeness in the process, and adding in all the humor and passion that we expect from a novel. What was once as stiff and two-dimensional as a medieval tapestry becomes rich and real and devastatingly sad. I have read this book more times than any other in my library. Okay, that's huge. The author, Lev Grossman, author of The Magicians, who we both admire greatly. And he's an interesting author for many reasons. But one is, like, he's someone that can write something devastatingly sad and introspective and psychological. And that's a lot of what this book is. It's very surprising how, like, philosophical and psychological this book is. But let me read another one, because here's another author, and it's an interesting comparison. A Fierce and Damaged Man, T.H. White, again, that's the author, wrote about fierce and damaged people and children and animals with a brilliant, painful innocence that has no equal in literature. He is so good at hurt and shame. How did he also manage to be so funny? I have laughed at his great Arthurian novel and cried over it and loved it all my life. This author, Ursula K. Le Guin.
Whoa.
Huge, right? You know? So that's two, right? You're like, dang, these people are going to bat, saying it's like one of their all-time greats. And again, Ursula, another psychological, introspective, somewhat depressing kind of author. You know, right in this vein, I'm like, ooh, these are interesting authors giving some of the highest endorsements you can give. Here's another one. This is the last one for now. The once and future king mingles wisdom, wonderful, laugh-out-loud humor, and deep sorrow while telling one of the great tales of the Western world. Guy Gavril Kaye. So we got an interesting mix here. And then, of course, there's other authors like J.K. Rowling and Neil Gaiman who have also cited direct influence from this work for some of their characters. And it just keeps going. The author of Wicked, Gregory Maguire, said he was influenced by White's ability to be intellectually broad-minded, to be comic, to be poetic, and to be fantastic. So just like tons of praise from this book throughout the years. And when you think about when this book came out, it was published in 1958, but it was a collection of 5 books that were written from 1938 to 1940. So this is the same time as like The Fellowship of the Ring came out in 1954. And those books were published earlier too. So right around the same time. And this is really very much a book that is a political allegory for World War II. And I can get into that later. But it's like written right in that time. And it has all these insane endorsements from all these authors who I have so much respect for. And I mean, Dylan, reading the, have you ever seen a collection of endorsements like that? Like, what was your reaction to hearing some of those?
Yeah, I mean, it is incredible. Some heavy hitters. I mean, I can only imagine that books like The Lord of the Rings or like the Lord of the Rings books would be similar in terms of just having these huge names talking about the influence. I mean, I had an idea that this was super influential, but maybe I was a bit off as to whom this would be so influential toward. Like, I mean, I see it now when you talk about Grossman. There's parts of the Magician series that I can be like, oh yeah, these very clearly parallel King Arthur very directly, I would say. It's not even his influence. He wears them on his sleeve. Like, he subverts a lot of it. Like, Narnia is part of his influence as well. But I am really impressed. I hear you talking about how it was different than you expected. And I feel like the authors that you ended up bringing up as people who endorsed it kind of intimates that. But I'd like to hear you talk more about the ways in which this was different than your expectations.
For sure. So when you hear that it's a retelling of King Arthur legends, and it starts with King Arthur as a child, goes through the sword and the stone, and goes all the way through the Knights of the Round Table and this and that, you're expecting more of like POV, King Arthur, like, you know, whatever, you know, just like Lord of the Rings, where it's like, and then he like went on this adventure, and then they stop and sang a song, and like all this other stuff, you know, that was happening in the 50s in fantasy at the time. But what really stood out right away is this book is pretty much told from the perspective of the author, like in 1940, you know, it's very much told in this way that it's just like, okay, here's the author and he's telling you the story and constantly references, air quotes, modern day, like concerns, and he references World War II, and Merlin experiences his time backwards. So Merlin is always like making references to like Hitler and stuff, like, you know, it's just like happens. So it's a very modern voice, especially for the time that it was written. And it uses satire, and I kind of think of like Terry Pratchett a little bit, where it's willing to be satirical and funny and critical of like modern English society in a lot of ways, where it's like, oh, these knights can't get out of their own way and they can't stop fighting, and like, oh, what if we did this or that, or oh, all these English witticisms, or have to stop for tea, or this or that, you know, like all the satire's kind of worked into it. So that really wasn't what I was expecting at all. And he's, during all of that, he's using that modern language to tell the story, and he has no problems mocking characters at times or making characters look silly, you know, like blundering, stumbling knights, or Merlin had this, was pulling out hairs in his beard and like seemed all disheveled, you know, like all this kind of stuff. But for the most part, it was told from literally a guy in the 19th, like right during or right before World War II. Like, World War II is unfolding, and this guy's telling the story of King Arthur, and he's really trying to understand, like, how violence and might, and because right over might is something that they repeat all the time. It's like, how can you both be right and be, like, a warlord at the same time? And he's very, very philosophical. There's entire chapters dedicated to like Merlin and animals, or King Arthur talking to animals, and they're going back and forth and like how to like, are humans capable of living without war? Like, is there such a thing as having knights and like not just killing people, you know, and they just are philosophizing over that over and over. None of which is what I was expecting from this book at all. But it's funny when you hear like Ursula Le Guin being like, here's a author who's suffering and like his work is suffering, but it's so beautiful at the same time and introspective. And that's really what it is. And I was very impressed by that aspect of it for sure.
A couple of things come up for me here, Charles, and it's super surprising for me as well. I guess in my head, the once and future king seemed like it would be this almost self-serious, like classic King Arthur tale. I had no idea that it was written from the perspective of someone in the modern day telling you the story, like, hey, almost it's like a frame story then, but I guess it's not quite
it is a narrative of the story, like third person whatever, but there's all the time tongue-in-cheek modern kind of points to it, and it's definitely like someone retrospectively being able to make fun of the characters or English society or history or something.
That's shocking to me too, is that there's so much humor in it. It's just totally different from what I was expecting, and maybe that's just me being totally uneducated when it comes to some of the history of the fantasy genre, but I feel like I usually am not this far off. And it's interesting that you are, like, you were surprised by it as well. Like, there's some sort of way in which this book is not talked about or portrayed in a way that is aligning with most authors' experiences of it when they're talking about the book and your experience having read it.
Right. And this is a book that a lot of people probably had like assigned reading to them in high school, you know, with like Johnny Tremaine and all that other crap. You know, it's like this same.
Oh, Johnny Tremaine takes a shot out of nowhere.
I remember, you know, you get those assigned readings. You're like, what is this? So it's just like this was assigned reading for people. And it can be kind of like it's an old book. It's assigned reading. It could have that like homework kind of mentality to it for a lot of modern audiences. And so I that's probably why it's been on my TBR for 10 years. And honestly, reading through like the whole thing cover to cover and like just a couple sittings in a few weeks, it was a lot. But it's super interesting how you mentioned like the humor aspect of it. And I think where the author, T.H. White, is winning points with people like Guy Gavril K., Ursula K. Le Guin, Lev Grossman, is like he is finding the line between like he doesn't portray King Arthur as this noble hero who does no wrong. Like he makes mistakes. He's very naive. He's you know, ultimately fails and this and that. And he also presents characters like Lancelot, who is, he makes him super ugly and he's like, makes him super, like, here's a guy who wants to perform miracles and be a saint of a knight, but he also like, has affairs and stuff at the same time. But meanwhile, he's like, but I also want to be super holy, but I'm conflicted by my love for this person who's married and, you know, that I'm having a relationship with, but I still want to do saintly deeds. You know, like he gets in the weeds of these characters and he finds the humor in it without it being like a noble tale like you would expect from a King Arthur story. And I think that's where he earns all his author points. And it's really interesting to see that. And you have these authors, especially like Le Guin, who is very anti-violence and tries to find some of the balanced nature of her characters and her themes, and, you know, where it's like, oh, here's a character who's struggling to find themselves and this and that, and there's beauty in that and poetry and in the sadness sometimes. And here's T.H. White writing about this in like the 30s, you know, so it was super to characters that traditionally were not viewed that way. They were viewed as like, you know, ye old heroes. So it was super interesting to kind of reposition him in that way and to take the time to be just super philosophical about it. Like, here's someone who, in trying to avoid wars and conflict in King Arthur, that he's also allowing people to, like, undermine him, and he knows it, but he's not saying anything about it because he's so naive and sheltered and thinking he's benevolent that he's letting people kind of scheme right in front of him, you know. But he, like, it's stuff like that that goes and goes throughout the book that you're like, this is actually really interesting, and a spin on these characters that you wouldn't otherwise get. And you can see how that would affect someone like Le Guin or Lev Grossman, who, like, just are actually trying to understand the human condition a little bit more and willing to dive into some of the more depressing stuff. But still, both of those books have very funny moments, especially Lev Grossman's The Magicians is genuinely funny, even though it's mostly about, like, depression and stuff like that. So, I don't know, it was super interesting to me to see, and it's one of those ones that maybe has a more of an academic kind of fulfillment for me than, like, an entertaining story. But it was very, very interesting in how it was written and portrayed, and I see how it could be, like, the beginning of this branch of fantasy where it's like, let's take another look at these characters from a different lens and let's focus on the philosophy of it really up close and make that the focus instead of the, oh, I pulled the sword from the stone and now I'm the king. Oh, but it's like, how would that affect the king that comes from that? You know, like, how would that person handle, like, affairs going on in his court or family trying to undermine him? Like, well, how would he react to that? You know, it's kind of interesting.
It sounds shockingly modern in that way. Where
the voice was very modern.
It makes me, just the idea of, let's take a look at what these characters might have actually been like, and everyone has flaws, so let's take the paragons of moral virtue and heroism, and let's make them into real people with those flaws on display. That sounds like something that almost is part of the grimdarky, more modern way of writing, where it's like, that's something that Abercrombie tries to work into, Joe Abercrombie tries to work into his novels, where it's like, anytime someone's like a hero of the past, blah, blah, blah. Like, let's take, for example, him jumping way forward in the First Law universe in his second trilogy. He's got some looking back. We won't bring up anything that would spoil anything, but obviously look back on some of the people from the first trilogy, and they're like viewed in lights that we know were kind of more complicated, and maybe they had a few more foibles, and maybe this event played out in a less epic way, that kind of stuff. That sounds pretty modern. It almost makes me think too about, you know, we read Loki by Melvin Burgess recently, and maybe about a year ago actually now. Time flies, Charles, am I right?
Time, it's just, is like, flying,
TikTok. Man. Not TikTok. The app, which I haven't been super active on lately, but but the, you know, the noise of a clock. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is, we get this super modern retelling of Norse mythology with Melvin Burgess's Loki, and he uses some of those tools as well, where it's like, oh, Thor, this guy who's depicted as this epic hero, and even in Disney, though, there's some funny stuff, like, he's played as this heroic character. In the Book of Loki, he's portrayed as this just, like, boneheaded, total, the most caricatured version of a jock who just has no depth at all. And it's super funny to look at those characters and see them in that light. And it sounds like it's really funny in this King Arthur retelling to look at some of these characters in a new light, foibles and all.
For
warts
sure.
and all, Charles. How did I miss that?
I know. Had it right there, warts dude. So close.
His name is Wart.
You had it, man. And one of the things you said really resonated is it's flaws on display, right? I think that's kind of the breakthrough for this like style of writing and what caught on for a lot of the next generation of fantasy authors. Because if you compare this to a contemporary like Lord of the Rings, for example, since they came out around the same time, where it's like we're not trying to think about why Aragorn maybe is the way he is or the flaws about him and how that could define some of his more human characteristics. It's like, no, he's like a god king, basically. I mean, yeah, he has his challenges and this and that, but it's mostly about this grand tale of good versus evil, right? And he's one of the good guys. And this is definitely a book where the author is like actively also trying to understand these characters and why they're doing what they're doing. And he's also trying to come to terms with World War II at the same time, like how this could happen. And he goes and looks back at the chivalrous time of King Arthur and the Round Table. And it's like, how can we learn from these things? And how can this king come back? Again, it's like the future king, like when King Arthur comes back and saves us all and brings chivalry back to the world and this and that. It's like, how is that even possible? And you can tell, and I think when Ursula says that, you know, what was her exact language? A fierce and damaged man. I think part of that presentation of damaged is THY doesn't know the answer. And he's in the thick of World War II is like actively happening. And he actually fled England and he's a conscientious objector and moved to Ireland. It's like, okay. But it's one of those things where it's like, you're writing a book and you're trying to understand these characters and you're also bringing in like the headlines around like this imminent world war. And it's trying to understand those things and not really presenting an answer, but more just like trying to offer hope that like, as long as there's people working to understand these things and bring chivalry and happiness, it's like he's figuring it out. And I think there's some misery around not being able to figure it out. And there's lengths and lengths of chapters where, you know, there's a lot of times where Merlin will turn Arthur into an animal and he'll go off and learn how to be a certain animal. And this whole thing where he's like a goose, he was all throughout his childhood, he made him animals and that was his learning process. But like one of the last chapters, King Arthur's an old man and Merlin's like, you're going to be a goose. You're going to go live with, he gets a goose wife and everything. And he's trying to, and he's just like, I don't want to be a human anymore. It's so much easier to be a goose. Like their society is so much easier and they just all fly together and they're, you know, there's no war, this or that. And they're talking about it. And it's like, well, we don't have like nations. And then it's like, well, but if like, we can't have knights just with nothing to fight for because then they'll just start fighting each other. Is that even possible? And it just goes down all of these things where they're trying to understand human nature and how to potentially avoid conflict and live peacefully. And it's never resolved, of course. And it's funny to compare it to him. Like, he's actually a goose at the time. You know, it's like kind of silly, but that's what this book tries to do. It's all the flaws on display and it's the grappling to understand like how society can exist peacefully. You know, that's one of the big questions that to me was really interesting. It's like, do we owe loyalty to our country? What if that conflicts with the loyalty to our family? Why do we even have wars? What are the causes of war? Can you prevent it? Is it like, is revenge worth it? Is that a human construct? Like all of these things, like how can you create peace? It's just like really interesting. And they sit down and have these discussions the whole time. And I think that's what really makes this like a progressive, especially for its time, story, and why, and you could see like why these certain authors are gravitating to it and why there's this whole branch of fantasy that is this way of kind of purpose seeking and introspective and philosophical. And a lot of it stems from work like this. Like it really was a progressive idea to do a retelling in this way. And like making it so closely related to the headlines at the time. You know, you could see how it could be really a breakout story.
That's well said, Charles, and the point is well taken. Even though geese are violent, horrible animals, and I hate them.
Yeah, and they crap everywhere.
Always, you know? Yeah. Oh yeah, you've been out here to Colorado during the goose crap season. Remember?
I do remember that. Yeah. I'm like, dang, there's geese everywhere. You're overrun, man. Can't step anywhere in this town.
Bad. It's so bad here, and. They also just hiss. Like, I remember at one point one like laid eggs outside of my second floor apartment at that time, and every time I would come out, it would just like immediately start hissing at me as soon as I start going down the steps. I was like afraid to leave my apartment. So all that being said, I like the idea of a more innocent society among animals and how that can impact one's understanding of the complications of our actual world. And I also see some, I won't say too much more, but I see some Grossman being influenced by what you're talking about there too, in a way that I had no idea of. But it sounds like a book that has a lot of relevance to our time right now as well. Even if we're not in the thick of World War II, there's a lot of modern events that might be interesting to think of in this context. And it almost makes me feel like it'd be super cool if someone tried to do it again, like the Once in Future King style, like revisit the King Arthur tale more from the like modern times of 2024 rather than the modern quote unquote now modern times of the 30s 1940s. Or 40s. So it would be kind of interesting because we have a whole new cast of often awful characters among our world. And we also have a time where there's a lot of war, a lot of horrible things going on. And maybe that's like most times at this point. But it would be super interesting to see the use of the King Arthur tale again in a modern time that we're in the
thick of. King Arthur is supposed to return, you know? That's what we're holding out for.
I mean, that's you think so, Charles? You think he's coming back?
Well, that's the whole point of the Once and Future King. He talks about it all the time. It's just here also begins, if perchance a man may in future time survive the petulance and continue the task he has begun, the hope of the future king. That's from the book. So it's just like they just hope that they can give us happiness in a world with chivalry, the only medieval blessing of simple people who tried in their old small way to still the ancient brutal dream of Attila the Hun. That's another line that I pulled from the book as well. For I am inclined to believe that my beloved Arthur of the future is something about is returning the best means to help our curious species. England and the world is ready to listen to reason. Give us happiness in a world. So something like, but yeah, Attila the Hun is a random reference, but yeah, just like the warlords of throughout time, you know, where it's like these conquerors like Attila, like Hitler. It's like these people who are just out to conquest. It's like, we need to go back to this chivalrous, simple, peaceful time. There's so much in the world that we can love and enjoy where conquest isn't necessary. And it's like, why do we feel the need to conquest? How can we rechannel that energy into something less warlike? You know, that's so much of what this book is trying to find. And they even talk about like, well, what about the ants? It's like, well, they're, you know, mindless and utilitarian. You could never apply that to humans. Like, they go through all this stuff, you know? So it is... Like, I think that's why retellings are so popular, because it is an interesting way to kind of come to terms with modern times. And it's, I mean, Ursula Le Guin pretty much invented the young adult novel through a similar, not a retelling, but through this similar, like, take a fantasy story and make it super introspective and make it super relatable. And like, that real philosophy to it. And that's where I think people will really enjoy this. Like, and I feel like you would get a lot of intrigue out of it because it takes the time to be super philosophical and psychological in its approach more than the average fantasy novel. But I will say, like, it's also, like, the audiobook was like 25 hours long. Like, it's five books put into one. It's a lot. It does have a little bit of that assigned reading kind of reading experience to it. Like, oh, I got to read the next couple chapters before class. You know, like, that's kind of the vibe I had every time I went into it. But it was still an academic pursuit that I'm glad I, while we had the time off from the show, finally got to cross off the TBR. So.
I see a lot of overlap with the themes explored in Le Guin's work, like you're saying, yeah. Charles. I mean,
she's looks work, to animals as well, and naturalism, yeah. Taoism. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And like you're saying, with animals, she emphasizes the innocence of animals and the balance with which they are in when it comes to the world, like, and humans kind of as just this
don't play to that script that, for yeah, some reason.
Just, yeah.
Just the only is, animals and is, that like, don't do this.
Yeah. And is like made worse by them is kind of where some see that as a very positive thing, like our ability to enforce our will on the world. But then, yeah, Le Guin, and it sounds like White to have themes of, well, maybe that's actually horrible. And
maybe that's the reason we have wars. Like, yeah. Wars are bad, you know, like that.
Yeah.
For sure. So, I mean, I would recommend it to any fantasy fan. I mean, it's worth giving it a shot. It can feel like homework at times, but it was really enlightening to see, and you made some interesting parallels to Lev Grossman and Ursula Le Guin. Like, you're like, oh man, this is where this whole branch of fantasy stems from that we enjoy so much, and you think it's like so unique, and it's like, how did they think to approach it this way? And it kind of starts here for a lot of modern authors. So super interesting. And you know, Guy Gavril Kay, who takes historical elements and retells them, you know, in his own worlds, but pulls heavily from history. It's like, it's super interesting to see all the influence coming together. And it is a way more modern voice. Like, to me, Tolkien reads more dated than this. Yeah. Like, if I had to just read a random passage and guess a decade, I would have been off. I would have said, like, 70s, you know, I would have been off by a while, by a long shot. So it's one of those things where it's like surprisingly modern voice. So it's not as brutal as presently Frodo walked through the plains and the green trees and singing happy tunes on his lambus bread, wielding his ancient weapon gifted to him by immortal elves. You know, it's like not that at all.
I'm unsure if that is a direct quote or not. It honestly could be. No. But the presently is always... Yes. Always there when it comes to Tolkien.
Always the presently. Just so you know what time you're
Frank Herbert, for some reason. But yeah, when you were reading those quotes, I was actually like, is there going to be a Tolkien quote? And I was like, oh no, that one sounds way too modern. Oh no, that one sounds way too modern. I was waiting for a presently. There is no book like a once and future king when it comes to, I don't know. But the only one that was probably said a while ago, although who knows, was the Ursula K. Le Guin one. But she always had a way more modern sounding voice, I felt like. And the idea of calling, I'm like, maybe he was dead by that time. White was dead by the time she was saying that. Because I was like, it's kind of weird to, in your endorsement of a book, like, make a comment about, like, how, what did she say, like, a fierce and damaged man, like, could you imagine coming out with a book
and a fierce and damaged, like, man, that's he's so good at book. Hurt and shame, how do you also manage to be so funny?
Like, could you imagine if it's like I don't know, I'll pick a big, like, okay, like Patrick Rothfuss comes out with a new book
That like, would be a fire blurb all, where it's just right? like FTF, and it's just a like, fierce and damaged fierce man, and damaged Patrick man. Rothfuss.
It's like, bro, like, just call me fierce and damaged.
It's like, although, I did not honestly, ask to be analyzed right now.
Yeah, honestly, if I had to write one very complimentary blurb about an author and call them fierce and damaged,
probably plenty of fantasy authors fit that bill these days. No worries.
Although I don't know if any feel like they fit it quite as well as Rothfuss.
Emotionally stunted and immature author like the so-and-so. It's like, bro, what? Clearly hasn't processed the divorce of his parents when he was 12 years old. This author right. writes this. You're like, whoa, we don't need to hit him that yeah, hard.
It's like, can you just say the book is good? Yeah. Like, you can say the characters are fierce and damaged. Although, Le Guin was always a tell it like it is person. There's some interesting quotes. If you see, she felt like JK copied a lot of what she did with Harry Potter from Wizard of Earthsea, and Le Guin was pissed about that she wasn't given any credit or listed as an influence. So she was fierce. I don't know if she was damaged, but probably, who among us is not, Charles?
Who among us is not? But, we all have a bit of, and that's what makes us human and interesting.
Yeah,
he did die in 64 at the age of 57, so it's possible that she dropped this, you know, in the 70s and beyond. Yeah. But she had been writing, you know, she was pretty active. She was born in 29. I forget. Oh, Earthsea came out in 68. So actually, yeah, she probably wasn't even famous until after he died. And so, yeah, she definitely was dropping those lines after he was gone.
It's weird to say that about a person who's still alive.
Yeah, for sure. He is long gone, for sure. But, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I'm glad I read it. I'm glad I went through the experience and have that kind of historical reference now. You know, it's super interesting. And especially now that we've read Dune, too, it's just like getting... diving into the classics, even though it's not the same reading experience as reading something modern, exciting, on the more entertaining side, dare I say, it still can be fulfilling and interesting. And that's what this experience was. So I was thankful to, and it's one heavy one off the TBR. You know, that is a huge, huge victory. So
you just feel lighter, Charles.
Oh, yeah, it's probably the book that's been on my TBR the longest that I haven't read. And so now that it's gone, like, I don't even know what the next book would even be now. I feel like the TBR is pretty much clean since I've read so many of these things. Lies of Luck, Lamora, Fifth Season. You know, I read Wise Men's Fear. I've read... Brandon Sanderson's Stormlight Archives, you know, like I finally crossed all those off the list. I don't even know what's left, you know. Wow.
Sounds like we might need a Friends Pitching Fantasy relatively soon to figure that out.
I think we do. There's some big releases that have come out this month, though, that I'm sure we're going to get into. And we've, you know, like I said, we did a lot of extra quickly reading that will be coming up on the show soon as well. So lots of fantasy to talk about. But yeah, we're going to have to start really looking, hunting for those next reads on the show for sure. And I'm looking forward to that.
Right. And in the meantime, on the more modern, exciting side of things, I am just about to finish the first book of Sebastian de Castell's Greatcoats series.
I'm very interested to hear about that.
Yeah.
He's on my TBR for sure. As an author. Just got to get him into my reading schedule for sure. So I'm really excited to hear what you have to say about that. Mark Lawrence has a new book that came out. Okay. Yes. The book that broke the world, the second book in his, is it the Library?
The
Library trilogy. Right. So, you know, we're going to be coming out with an episode on that soon. So get to reading that if you haven't already. And then, FPF is going to be around the corner. So, be on the lookout, guys. It's a lot of exciting content coming to the show. For now, that's a wrap on The Once and Future King
by T.H. White. Charles's official word on the book is, if it comes down to The Once and Future King and Johnny Tremaine, choose The Once and Future King. Not quite the level of endorsement that Ursula K. Le Guin gave, but at least you didn't attack the author in it.
Man, whoever wrote Johnny Tremaine was also a damaged man for sure. I don't remember who it was. Johnny, I don't even remember what that was about. That was like Revolutionary War time.
I was like, that is such a random book to have chosen. Like, I can't.
Well, I just remember that was the first book that was like required reading at school that I just was torture to read. Revolutionary War. Book by, Esther Forbes. Misgender? Yeah, Esther Forbes. Female author, shout out. Probably damaged, a fierce and damaged woman for sure. But
the first woman elected to membership in the American Antiquarian Society.
Oh, wow. The Antiquarian Society. Wow.
That's who you are attacking, Charles.
You know you're not getting in there without having some kind of damage. You're not.
Definitely not.
Newbery Medal winning novel, guys. Check it out.
It's in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Oh, Worcester.
That's how you say it, right? Worcester? How do you say
Worcester.
That?
It's Worcester. It's spelled Worcester, and it's pronounced Worcester.
Worcester. You do have deep Massachusettsian roots.
My sister went to WPI. I've been to Worcester many times.
Wow. Does it live up to the hype?
I'm going to say yes.
Which is more a statement about the level of hype.
Yeah, than exactly. I was like, depend on your level of hype. Like, I think it will, you know. It's not like Las Vegas. I hope it lives up to the hype.
You know what lived up to the hype, according to Charles? The Once and Future King. Bringing it back.
We're back.
Bringing it home.
We're back. Yep.
I think we're ready for that sweet, sweet outro music, Charles, before I start reading straight from the Wikipedia page of the American Antiquarian Society, which is both learned society. You know that you're supposed to read this as learned. You're not supposed to say a learned society. You'd say a learned society and a national research library of pre-20th century American history and culture. All right, let's get that sweet, sweet outro music pumping.
So glad it's in there, you know. Yeah, let's get that pumping. Right now.
Learn it.
Thank you all, one and all, for listening to yet another very exciting episode of the Friends Talking Fantasy podcast. If you like what you heard today and you want to support the show, one of the best ways to do that is to engage with us over on the socials. Give us a like and some engagement over on, I guess, TikTok and Instagram at the FTF podcast and Twitter at the FTF podcast with a number 1 at the end. Now, Dylan, if they like what they heard today and they want to support the show even more than engaging with us over on the socials, what can they do?
Toss 5 stars to our podcast, which you can do over on Spotify. To do that, you just click about and then click where the stars are and then click 5 of them, and that would make us feel really good if you were to do that. You can also rate and review on Apple Podcast. That means you can say nice things about us, or you can say nice things about Worcester.
Yeah, Worcester? There you go.
Worcester, Massachusetts. You can tell us if it lived up to the hype, as long as you
shout
include that
Worcester
in a 5-star review. And you know what? It always puts a smile on our face when you do that. But just listening is more than enough. Thank you so much for doing that.
Well said, Dylan. Just listening more than enough. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much for making it all the way to the end. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You guys are great. And as always, go forth and conquer, friends.
Worcester.
Worcester.